It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about the early days of the AIDS epidemic with a memoir of love and tragic loss. First, this weekend, a global ransomware cyber attack hit 150 countries. Ransomware is a type of virus that locks a user's computer until the user pays to release it. The attack started slowing down Monday. Apparently, only about $50,000 has been paid so far. Dave Schrader joins us now to talk about what happened this weekend and how you can protect yourself from this and maybe future ransomware attacks. He's a strategist for the Division of Information Technology at UW-Madison. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. My pleasure. Thanks.
Well, first of all, Dave, tell us what happened over the weekend. This spread quickly around the world.
It did. So this ransomware you've seen referred to as either WannaCrypt or WannaCry, and it started spreading largely in organizations that had computers that were not patched, that weren't up to date with the latest security fixes from Microsoft. And if you were infected, what a user would see when they turned on their computer is this box would pop up saying, oops, your important files have been encrypted, and give them a warning that they needed to pay within a week if they wanted to see those files again.
And this is not the first ransomware attack we've seen. This is one element of cyber problems that we're seeing, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. There's ransomware is not new. It's a type of malicious software that, just like you said, encrypts a user's files with strong encryption. Sometimes it's even the same encryption that you're using legitimately on your devices to protect your own files. If someone steals your device or gets a hold of your data, they won't be able to encrypt it if they don't have the right password or passcode. But in this case, it's an attacker encrypting your files with their encryption key, and you don't have access to those files then.
Unless you pay them the ransom in bitcoins in this case. What's the advice generally if an individual user or a company or a hospital, as was the case here, should people pay to get access to their own files?
Well, the situation is difficult if you don't have that data backed up. So in certain cases, there might be an instance where someone has backups, but they're old, and and there's no way that security firms have developed to actually decrypt these files. Sometimes security firms are able to reverse engineer ransomware and provide tools that people can use to decrypt those files and get access to them again. But in this case, there is no fix other than paying the attackers. And, some people may choose to pay because if they don't have access to backups or they really need those files back, sometimes they determine that the quickest path is just to pay. And unfortunately, you're really giving money to criminals, essentially, at that point. But sometimes there's no other option.
Where are we now, now that it's Monday on this? I understand one user found some kind of kill switch to shut down this ransomware attack. Does that mean the problem's over or just morphing as we watch?
Well, there was a security expert at a outfit called Malware Tech who registered a domain name, which is something like, whatever.com or what have you, that he found embedded in the malware. And he registered it to try to track the malware and see if he could find out more about where it was coming from, how it was controlled. And it turned out that the act of him registering this domain name ended up killing one variant of this ransomware, not allowing it to spread further. But we've already seen other variants of this ransomware out there. And over the weekend, we didn't really know, when Monday rolled around, would people go to their desks in their office and find, this ransomware was on their computers. And fortunately, it doesn't look like there was any big explosion, but it's still spreading. And as you said, it's been seen in over 150 countries, and it's affected thousands of people. And that $50,000 that we sort of assess has been paid to whoever's behind this ransomware might not seem like a lot of money, but with ransomware, it could be anything from, a large criminal cyber gang to just one individual. And $50,000, depending on where you are in the world, could be a lot of money.
We're talking to Dave Schrader from UW-Madison's Division of Information Technology, looking at this big cyber hostage-taking ransomware attack that started on Friday, still going on in varying forms around the world. Dave, people listening are probably thinking, okay, I don't want these things to happen to my computer, my workplace, whatever. What kind of advice is out there? What should we be doing?
Well, the best advice is the same advice that people have probably heard many times, which is keep your computers and your devices up to date with the latest security patches and never click links, download attachments, or things like that in email messages that are unsolicited or unexpected. Now, in the case of this WannaCrypt ransomware, a user didn't actually have to click anything to become infected. It was using a vulnerability, actually quite an old vulnerability, in Microsoft Windows to spread itself. So in addition to being ransomware, it was also acting as a worm. A worm is a type of malware that will try to spread on its own by searching other computers, either on the local network or even out on the internet. And if it finds one that has this vulnerability, it will go ahead and infect that computer too.
Now, people have been criticizing the NSA, the National Security Agency, apparently knowing about this vulnerability, not revealing it until it was leaked. What do we know about that?
So what we know is that there was a group, another group whose identity we don't actually know, called the Shadow Brokers, that has been leaking what are purported to be tools that may be cyber weapons that are used to exploit vulnerabilities in computer systems and software that aren't known by the manufacturers of that software. So the United States typically discloses vulnerabilities that it discovers, including the intelligence community, but the practice is that some vulnerabilities that are viewed to be important that might be used for foreign intelligence purposes are kept. And this is a controversial practice because it means those vulnerabilities are still out there until someone else publicly discovers them or leaks them, as in the case of the Shadow Brokers. So once this vulnerability was leaked, the intelligence community did inform the vendors, hey, we think that there's a vulnerability here that needs to be fixed that you should be aware of. Microsoft did issue a patch. So anyone who had updated their systems over the last few months was already not vulnerable to this particular problem. But it was such an old vulnerability that Microsoft actually also released a patch for Windows XP, which is a version of Windows that came out before 9/11, just to give a little bit of perspective, and also hadn't received any security updates for almost a decade. Until now. So they released a patch for that too. The problem with things like Windows XP, a lot of people might wonder, well, who's still using that? And there are a lot of organizations out there, government organizations, healthcare organizations, companies that have these older systems around for a variety of reasons, or have Windows systems around that might not be patched. And these are the ones that were the most heavily affected by it.
And Dave, as we wrap up, just reiterating the point, it sounds like if we think that updating our virus software or getting virus software in the first place is a drag, we should just grin and bear it and actually do the work?
Exactly. You should just do it. And when Windows or your iPhone or anything is coming around reminding you, hey, there's a security update that's available, it's always a hassle to install it, but please just go ahead and install those updates. Keep your security software current. And even though it wasn't an issue in this case, this was an issue with the Google Docs phishing scam that we saw a couple of weeks ago. Another common way for ransomware or malicious software to spread is those phishing emails. So again, don't click, don't download attachments, especially if you're getting a message that's unexpected or unsolicited, because if it seems fishy, it probably is.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. Take care.
That's Dave Schrader, strategist for the Division of Information Technology at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the global ransomware attack this weekend. Right now, being young and falling in love can be a wonderful experience. Every relationship has its challenges, but if you were a gay man in the early 1980s, there was more to deal with. The realization that many men in your community were falling ill and dying from a mysterious disease. Michael Ward is the author of the recently released memoir, The Sea is Quiet Tonight. He shares both the wonderful and difficult aspects of his life with Mark Halberstadt before, during, and after Mark's diagnosis with AIDS. Michael Ward will be in Milwaukee for an event tonight and in Madison tomorrow. He joins us from our WPR studios in Milwaukee. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you set the scene for us? What was it like being a young gay man in the late 70s and early 1980s?
Before AIDS, it was pretty exciting because we had gone through a whole decade of what is commonly called gay liberation. We always thought of it as being a revolution. And all the contraction around shaming and homophobia seemed to have lifted to some extent, so that there was a lot of partying.
And how did you and Mark first meet?
We met on Fire Island at something called Tea Dance, which was a dance that was held every afternoon from 5 to 7 on a big boardwalk next to the ocean on Fire Island. And there were hundreds of men dancing, and I got there late, and I cut through the crowd and ran into an old friend of mine, and she introduced me to Mark.
And was it love at first sight or nearly at first sight?
Nearly at first sight. It was funny because he had a new camera, and he you couldn't really talk, so he shouts into my ear, "Do you want to go for a walk with me while I take some pictures?" And by the time we'd gone for a walk for an hour, he had invited me over to the place where he was staying for dinner with a whole bunch of other guys. And one thing led to another, and we were inseparable after that, really.
And even today, it can be difficult for people to come out to friends, families, and coworkers. What was it like for you back then? Less acceptance outside of that community, meeting each other's families. What kind of issues did you deal with?
Good question. I had come out to my family in 1974 when I had gotten into a consciousness-raising group, and I met Mark in 1981. My parents were very blue-collar Omaha people. My father worked in a dairy. But they were terrific with me about it. They didn't understand it. Mark's parents were much more conservative, and he refused to deal with being gay with them because his mother was so reactive to it.
Did you meet his family as a close friend?
No, he actually took me. Well, yes, he took me to meet them. There's a chapter in the book about that where he took me to meet them, and they knew perfectly well what our relationship was by then because we had been together for 8 months, and I loved his mother. He had a difficult relationship with her, but I felt very close to her from the beginning. She wanted to be close.
Not like any relationship, you had ups and downs and challenges, but can you talk about some of the high points?
Okay. Well, for me, one of the high points was his willingness to move to Boston. He had just moved from New York to Fort Lauderdale. He was moving from being a teacher to, he wanted to be a boat captain, sailing boats. And so problem was, well, there was a lot of distance between us. I had just moved to Boston and established a psychotherapy practice. And so the difficulty really was in trying to bridge the distance and find sailing work for him in Boston, which was not so easy.
Now, happy times in some ways, but this cloud kept gathering. What's your first memory of being aware of this mysterious illness that we eventually identified as HIV/AIDS?
Mark had six partners in New York with whom the group of them owned a building on 18th and Broadway, which they converted from, it had been a warehouse and a manufacturing building. And over a period of years, they converted them into lofts. And one of his partners in that building got sick and died within 2 months in 1981. And that was our first experience with knowing someone, although we had no idea what he had died from. Nobody did.
And you started seeing reports in mostly gay-oriented media. What kind of fear was starting to develop there?
Well, the fear, especially in New York and San Francisco, because that's where the first cases were, developed very rapidly because all of a sudden dozens, you know, first it was a few and then it was dozens and then it was hundreds of gay men were getting sick, being hospitalized. They couldn't figure out how to diagnose them. And then they were dying. And, you know, over a period of time, all of a sudden it was massive numbers.
Tell us what led to Mark's diagnosis.
He developed shingles first, and then he developed thrush, oral thrush, both of which are things that you can develop. Certainly you don't have to have AIDS to get those things. Finally, he developed a persistent cough, and the cough got serious enough that we decided that he saw somebody to see if it was pneumonia, and it wasn't. So finally he went to see a specialist, and that's when he was diagnosed with pneumocystis.
We're talking about the early days of the AIDS and HIV epidemic in the United States. Michael Ward is with us, retired psychotherapist. His memoir is The Sea is Quiet Tonight. This quickly, not just in your life, but in the communities in San Francisco, New York, and elsewhere, became a devastating experience. I understand you have a segment to read to us. So would you,
I do.
Would you be able to do that, Mark?
Sure.
Mike?
This scene occurs about 6 weeks before Mark died. In early June, we hit a hard patch. Mark was tiring more easily again without the gamma interferon. I drove him down to New York City on a Friday to stay for 2 nights with close friends and to meet with his attorney. He perked up when we crossed over the Triborough Bridge into Manhattan, clearly looking forward to being away from the gloom of Boston. I dropped him off at the attorney's office and then drove out to Fire Island for a couple of nights by myself. Knowing that he was with people who loved him relieved me briefly of my hypervigilance. We had one short phone check-in on Saturday morning, and he sounded fine. I spent 2 days walking the long stretch of beach between Cherry Grove and the Pines, crisscrossing the boardwalks we had walked, passing the house where we had had our first night together. By this time, two more of the 6 roommates with whom he had shared that house were sick. AIDS was inescapable. I was reminded of Mark at every turn. In the late afternoons, I sat at the bar in the Monster, drinking beer, simply trying to allow my central nervous system to calm down. It was a relief to be alone and to zone out. I felt like a soldier on furlough from the front. When Mark arrived in Cherry Grove on Sunday, he was ashen and short of breath. As near as I could put together, he was responding to what had happened in Boston in the few days we'd been gone. His friends and the people with AIDS group were under siege. Pedro Martinez had died the day we left, David Tiffany remained in a coma, and Richard was convinced that he would be next to make 3.
Mike, what was it like to be in the midst of all this suffering and death, focused so much on your community, the nation at large, not experiencing this, not taking it seriously, and joking about it in some cases, as I recall, and then seeing it as God's punishment in other instances?
It was brutal. I mean, the lack of... Mark was the 100th person in Boston or in Massachusetts to be diagnosed with AIDS. And so it was so new. And we were very fortunate to have Dr. Jerome Groopman. He had just moved to Boston from Los Angeles, where some of the first cases were found. And so the medical care was caring, if not informed, since nobody was informed. And the AIDS Action Committee was formed at the same time, and we were both very active in that. But the lack of general public consciousness, and especially the lack of government support, was heartbreaking.
Mark eventually passed away. His last words, you write, when he was still able to talk, were, "I'm not going to die." Why did you write this book? Was it an effort to make sure that Mark didn't die, ultimately?
God bless you for saying that. I've never thought of it that way. There's a scene at the very beginning of the book in the preface where I'm in the waiting room at the hospital when he's just been diagnosed, and I'm calling his parents to tell them. And I'm standing there, and the thought that keeps going through my mind is, nothing is ever going to be the same. And that scene stayed with me for 30 years after he died. And I retired 3 years ago, and I decided, well, now I can write that book. And I did. And it's a way, I feel, of keeping his story and our story alive long beyond our time here.
You write about feeling survivor's guilt. Why did they die and you didn't?
Yes. And I think that's a very common feeling. I don't feel like I behaved any differently than any of my many, many friends who died. And I don't understand why, but I do feel like I've written something that honors them and keeps their memories alive.
Mark, you mentioned was a sailor. I wanted to be a boat captain. The title of your book, "The Sea Is Quiet Tonight."
Yes,
can you connect that up for us?
Sure. There's a scene where we're sailing before he's sick, where we visit a gravesite that was just off the side of the road in Bar Harbor, Maine. And it was obviously a sailor's site. And the line, "The sea is quiet tonight," was on that gravestone. And we both loved it. We thought it was so beautiful for a sailor to have that as the line on his epitaph. And so when Mark died, I had that engraved on his gravestone.
Now, you're speaking, as we mentioned, in Milwaukee and Madison. Do you have the event details handy so people can check that out?
Yes. Tonight, I'm reading at Outwards Bookstore at 7 p.m., and tomorrow night in Madison, I'm reading at A Room of One's Own at 6 p.m.
And can you leave us with a message to people struggling? All of us are going to go through it sometime. People struggling with the slow passing of a loved one.
Yes. Keep your heart open and remember to breathe. I did a lot of meditation during those years, and I still do. And coming back to the breath always grounds me.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
That's Michael Ward. He's a retired psychotherapist. We've been talking about his memoir. It's called "The Sea is Quiet Tonight." Chronicles losing his partner Mark to AIDS in the early 1980s. Again, he'll be speaking in Milwaukee tonight at 7 at Outwards Books, Madison tomorrow at A Room of One's Own. That's at 6 p.m. tomorrow in Madison. When President Trump won Wisconsin in the 2016 general election, it was by about 23,000 votes. Political watchers were surprised at the outcome given Wisconsin's history as a blue state in presidential elections. A new study from the left-leaning Super PAC claims that Wisconsin's voter photo ID law could have led to the suppression of 200,000 votes, mainly from voters who are African-American or Democratic voters, and that in turn could have had a major impact on the outcome of the election here in the state. Ari Berman joins us now to talk more about that study. He's a senior contributing writer for The Nation and author of the book "Give Us the Ballot: The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America." Ari, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, what were some of the individual stories you heard from people who weren't able to vote here in Wisconsin?
Sure. So I was in Wisconsin on Election Day, and I was also there during the primaries as well. So I saw these stories up close, both in terms of my own reporting and then in terms of reading others' stories and then in terms of reading court depositions and things like that. But one of the things that really struck me, and I wrote about this in the lead for my article about the study, was a story of a guy by the name of Eddie Lee Holloway Jr., who was a 58-year-old African-American man who moved from Illinois to Wisconsin. And when he went to get a voter ID in Milwaukee, he brought his Illinois photo ID, his birth certificate, and his Social Security card, but he couldn't get an ID for voting because the name on his birth certificate said Eddie Jr. Holloway instead of Eddie Lee Holloway Jr. And thus began this crazy Kafka-esque process for him to try to get a voter ID. He went down to Vital Records in Milwaukee, and he said, "How much will it cost to amend my birth certificate?" They told him between $400 and $600, which I don't think was accurate, but nonetheless, that's what they told him. They said he had to go back to Illinois and amend his birth certificate there. He went back to Illinois, was not able to do it there. The net effect was that this one voter made seven trips to two different states, spent over $200 of his own money, and still wasn't able to vote in Wisconsin. And there are, unfortunately, lots of these stories out there.
Those are stories kind of one at a time. Tell us about this study now looking at Wisconsin voter ID and voter turnout.
So what this study, which was done by Priorities USA, which is a Democratic group, so I say that in the piece that you have to first off to start with the caveat that this was done by a group that supports Democratic candidates. Their study found that Wisconsin's voter ID law could have suppressed up to 200,000 votes, because what they looked at is they found that in states that did not adopt strict voter ID laws in 2016, turnout increased by 1.3%. But in Wisconsin, turnout decreased by 3.3%. And they were saying that if voter ID was one of the reasons why this decrease happened, that meant that there was 200,000 fewer votes. And of those 200,000 fewer votes, those people that were more likely to be quote-unquote lost voters were more likely to be African-American, were more likely to be Democratic. And so they found that the voter ID law did have a suppressive effect, that voter ID laws nationally had a suppressive effect, and the biggest impact was in Wisconsin.
Now, people have certainly shared this study online. Democratic voters in particular, I think, see this 200,000 votes deterred. This could have made the difference. Some people are more skeptical, saying, well, there could be other things. You know, Wisconsin voters in the primaries weren't big fans of Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. They both lost the primary here. There might be something else about Wisconsin that accounts for this drop in voter turnout.
Sure, and I think that's absolutely reasonable. I think it's very difficult to say why people didn't turn out. I will say, though, that based on my own reporting, Wisconsin has had an especially large number of stories about people who couldn't vote because of the voter ID law. Not just my own reporting, but there was a very extensive Associated Press story that ran last week that detailed multiple stories of people who had problems voting. Wisconsin was taken to court multiple times, not just because of the voter ID law, but because the DMV was not issuing people IDs. So there were lots of issues there. And if you compare Wisconsin, for example, to Minnesota, it's interesting because those, as you know, very, very similar states, very competitive states on all fronts. And Minnesota did not experience the same kind of decreases in turnout that Wisconsin did, even though Wisconsin had not only a competitive presidential election, but a competitive Senate election, which Minnesota did not. And the study found that turnout was down in Wisconsin versus Minnesota, and also turnout in African-American counties, places like Milwaukee, dropped off at significant higher levels than in similar places in Minnesota. So I think the voter ID law at least contributed to the decrease in turnout in Wisconsin.
We're talking to Ari Berman from The Nation magazine, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, looking at the impact of voter ID laws on voter turnout, especially here in Wisconsin. Ari, how does our law here in Wisconsin when it comes to photo ID at the polling station, how does that compare to what other states have done?
One of the strictest in the country. First off, the federal courts found that 300,000 registered voters, which was 9% of the electorate, did not possess strict forms of ID when this law was passed. So that's a very large number. You're talking about 9% of the electorate in a state where elections are often very, very close. Now, obviously, some people were able to get these IDs, but we saw a lot of problems in Wisconsin, not just the fact that so many people didn't have the ID, but when I was there reporting in September of 2016, we received recordings from the DMV that showed that people were told that they had to pay to get a free ID, which was not true, that they had to present multiple underlying documents, which was not true. So Wisconsin was taken to court by groups like the ACLU a number of different times throughout this process. And then we had statements from people like Glenn Grothman, member of Congress, saying that the photo ID law was going to help Donald Trump win the election. And so that kind of rhetoric was fairly alarming as well. So Wisconsin had one of the strictest laws. I think it had some of the worst implementation of any state and some of the most provocative statements. And it's unfortunate because Wisconsin, as you know, has had a history of being very progressive on voting rights. So I think that's what made Wisconsin different from Texas. In Texas, you have consistently low voter turnout, lots of apathy. In Wisconsin, you have consistently high voter turnout, very engaged people when it comes to elections. So I think the voter ID law had a particular impact in a state like Wisconsin, which is not used to these kind of restrictions on voting.
Do you think that voter ID laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere were passed with the intent of driving down voter turnout in certain communities?
I do. I believe that's true because if you look at who didn't have forms of ID in Wisconsin, it was much more likely to be African-American and Latino voters. That's why the voter ID law was initially struck down before it was reinstated by a panel of Republican judges on the Court of Appeals. Other things that Wisconsin did, like cutting early voting, was invalidated. The judge in that case said that the restrictions on early voting disproportionately targeted African-American and Democratic-leaning voters in Milwaukee. So it wasn't just voter ID. There were other things that happened there. There were allegations, for example, State Senator Dale Schultz, who was a Republican, who's now retired, said that in meetings of Republican lawmakers, they talked about restricting voting rights for African-Americans, restricting voting rights for college students. This was a Republican member of the Senate who was making this claim. So I think there's a lot of evidence that this was done intentionally, and that, quite honestly, it worked.
The case for voter ID is that it's a fairly straightforward way to make sure I can't impersonate somebody else at the polling station. I can't fraudulently vote in someone else's name. Does it have some of that benefit?
Well, I think the problem problem is that that type of fraud, voter impersonation fraud, is exceedingly rare. That Wisconsin didn't present a single case of voter impersonation in court that the law would have stopped. It's a very inefficient and dumb way to steal an election. If someone shows up and says they're Ari Berman, they're most likely to get caught. First off, most people know, the most polling workers know the people voting at that place. Secondly, there's other less restrictive ways to confirm who somebody is. And thirdly, to commit voter fraud, you have to know where someone lives. You have to know that they haven't voted before. You have to know that they're not going to subsequently try to vote. Then doing all of those things, you're only casting one extra ballot, and you're risking a felony, you're risking 5 years in jail, and you're risking never being able to vote again. So I'm not saying that voter fraud never happens, but I think it's quite rare, and the threat of it has been exaggerated, I think, dramatically. And you look at the number of people who didn't have strict forms of ID, 300,000 according to the federal court. Look at the number of cases of voter impersonation in Wisconsin, which was zero according to federal court records, and it seems like many more people are being burdened than cases of voter impersonation that this might have stopped.
I want to step outside of Wisconsin for a moment and look at some news from the U.S. Supreme Court today. North Carolina, their laws, including voter ID laws, there had been court challenges. Those laws were overturned. Supreme Court decided not to take them up due to a fairly long and rambling legal narrative leading up to that. But what do you make of this decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to not take that up? That means those laws will still not be in effect in North Carolina.
Well, I think it's very significant because North Carolina passed one of the strictest, if not the strictest, restrictions on voting, and they did so just a month after the Supreme Court ruled in June of 2013 that states with the longest history of discrimination, which included North Carolina, no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. So they didn't just require voter ID. They cut Election Day registration. They eliminated Election Day registration, which Wisconsin still has. They cut early voting. They eliminated out-of-precinct voting. They eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds. In July of 2016, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that that law targeted black voters, in the court's words, with almost surgical precision. And they said that some parts of the law were, in the court's words, as close to a smoking gun as you'll ever see in modern times. So that was remarkable language for a court of appeals in this day and age to use. And I think that if the Supreme Court had reinstated this law, number one, it would have made it a lot harder to vote in North Carolina, but number two, it would have had ripple effects all across the country, because I think people are looking at North Carolina, they're looking at Wisconsin, they're looking at Texas, and they're wondering which way the wind is going to blow. Is the Supreme Court going to uphold these laws or not? And that's going to have an impact on whether more states do these kind of things in the future.
We're talking to Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, talking about new claims that more than 200,000 votes could have been suppressed in the 2016 election in Wisconsin because of the state's voter ID law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin's voter ID law is too restrictive, or do you think it's a good idea and necessary to prevent possible voter fraud? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's voter ID law garnered a lot of controversy when it was implemented leading up to the 2016 presidential election. A new study claims that as many as 200,000 people could have had their votes suppressed as a result. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think the new law had a big impact on the election, on its outcome? Do you think the state should continue with the voter ID requirement, or would you like to see it overturned or changed in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Ari Berman stays with us, senior contributing writer for The Nation, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Dick with us in Middleton. Hi.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that, well, I think, first of all, voter ID, I haven't been hearing much of it today, but it should not be that hard to get. It's a year in advance, but you said voter fraud. Well, I know, in fact, there were like 70-some young people that were 17 going on 18 thought they could vote or tried to and registered and voted, and I guess some of the clerks didn't catch it. I know they threw out 70-some, and so to say that there's no voter fraud, if you did an audit of every precinct in the state or every state and looked at every name, and you would find that there is some voter fraud. But I know there was over 70-some here in Wisconsin that got thrown out.
Dick, thanks for the call. And I don't know if you'd seen that story, Ari. It was in the primary. There's a belief spread online that if you were going to be 18 by the time of the general election, you could vote in the primary, even though you weren't 18 yet, which I guess is true in some states, not in Wisconsin, though. And so these votes that Dick is talking about got thrown out.
Okay, well, I hadn't heard that. That sounds more like a misunderstanding of the law than an actual attempt to try to defraud the process. It's interesting, you know, there was a recount in Wisconsin, there was a recount in Michigan, there was a recount in Pennsylvania, and the backdrop of this was partly the fact that Donald Trump said that there was going to be massive voter fraud, but when the recounts happened, Trump's own lawyers said in court that the election was not tainted by fraud. So sometimes you have to pay attention to the legal documents themselves because that's where people are most truthful and ignore some of the rhetoric. And even Trump's own lawyers said that the election was not tainted by fraud.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Wayne in Marshfield. Wayne, hi.
Hi. I'm a retired state employee, and I worked with visually impaired people in the northern part of the state. Three of the counties I worked in were on Michigan border. And there are dozens, I am sure, of voters there that have voted faithfully and then all of a sudden couldn't vote because of transportation problems, limited hours in the DMV offices, and the need for getting a birth certificate and so on. And because of all these hindrances, they've voted before, but all of a sudden they can't vote. And in a small community, the poll workers know who these people are, and there wouldn't be any question of whether they're legitimate or not. But because of the law, I would guarantee, just in the areas that I worked, dozens of people said, forget it. It's too much problem getting this special voting.
Wayne, thanks for the story. And Ari, in your reporting, did you see stories like that?
I did see stories like that, and that's a really good point. So I wrote about a story, and the Associated Press also wrote about the story of an 85-year-old couple where the wife was undergoing cancer treatments. They had always voted in Plymouth, Wisconsin, but she had an expired driver's license because she no longer drove. That was not accepted for voting, so they said she'd have to go to the closest DMV, which was over 1 hour, a round trip away. She was someone who was undergoing chemotherapy at the time, and she just didn't have the energy to go there. So she was unable to vote. She was unable to get a voter ID. Her husband was so angry, he decided not to vote either. After the election, this woman unfortunately passed away, and her husband said he's so angry about it, he's not going to vote anymore either because they always voted together. So these stories to me are quite tragic because I think there was very, very little risk of an 85-year-old couple committing voter fraud. But you see the kind of burdens that some of these people have to have, that they have to travel a long way to get to the DMV, or they can't make the trip at all. There's one county in Wisconsin where the DMV is only open 5 Wednesdays a year. So it's not always easy for people who don't have this kind of documentation or have documentation that's expired. So for a lot of people, it's not a big deal, but for certain people, particularly people that are older, more marginalized, lower down the socioeconomic ladder, it can be a real burden.
We're talking to Ari Berman from The Nation magazine, looking at voter ID here in Wisconsin and beyond. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Maquonago. Chris, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I find a lot of this ridiculous. You have to have an ID for everything nowadays. You have to have an ID to check out a book, to check out a movie. I mean, how do these people survive without an ID? You know, if it's that big of a deal, why don't we round them up in buses like they do to take them to the polling places? Take them a month ahead and get them driver's licenses or IDs. I just find it ludicrous that in this day and age, all these 200,000 people don't have an ID. I find it ridiculous.
Chris, thanks for the call. Ari, Chris isn't alone. A lot of people wonder, it's hard to go through life without getting some form of ID. Is it really that hard to get them in order to vote?
Well, the problem is not that people don't have IDs, it's that they don't have IDs that are accepted by the state of Wisconsin under a very narrow definition of what qualifies. So I would urge the caller to look at a very in-depth Associated Press story that was done this week. Maybe you can link to it on your website. But they interviewed a Navy vet who served in Iraq and Afghanistan who recently moved from Illinois to Wisconsin. He had an Illinois driver's license. He had valid ID, the kind of ID that he could use to drive, to cash a check, to rent a book, to buy liquor, all of these things. But that was not accepted in Wisconsin because Wisconsin doesn't accept out-of-state IDs as valid IDs in the same way that Wisconsin doesn't accept student IDs from a number of universities in the state because they don't comply to the state's rules. And this guy was working 50 hours a week and didn't have time when he first moved to switch over his ID in time. So it's not as simple as people think. Everyone has some form of ID. The problem is not everyone has an in-state driver's license. Not everyone has an in-state ID. And there, that's where you start to run into some issues here.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jenny with us in Madison. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I was just calling in about the experience of an out-of-state voter. So I'm a UW student from Arkansas. And in the primary election, I came in with my driver's license and proof of residence like I'd used in 2012 and was told I needed to get a voter ID card made, which I did, and it has a picture of me from when I was 18 as opposed to my driver's license, which is a new picture. When I went to go vote for the state superintendent with my voter ID, I was told I also needed a bus pass, which I don't have because I don't ride the bus, and I was told that if I could pull up an email from a professor, that would work. So voter ID and email from a professor this year.
So, wait, a bus pass and a note from a professor? What would, to back up which part of the ID?
The voter ID, and I told them I had a driver's license and student ID with me, but I was told that a bus pass was more secure.
Jenny, thanks for the call. I have not heard of anything like this, Ari. Have you?
I haven't heard about this either, but one of the things you have to realize is that the law is not implemented in a uniform manner, that from polling place, from county to county, you can get very, very different interpretations of the law, of what's required, of what will be accepted. The very fact that students would have to get a separate ID from their schools just for voting, which had to happen at the University of Wisconsin, which happened at Marquette and all these other places that I visited, is pretty absurd. I mean, for students to have to go through a completely different step to be able to vote, I think was a burden for a lot of them. And sometimes you can overcome this stuff, and sometimes if you're not really that crazy about voting, if you're not really that crazy about the candidates to begin with, you might say, oh, it's just gotten more difficult. Why should I bother in the first place? And I think two things happened with the voter ID law in Wisconsin. Number one, some people just couldn't participate, and other people just decided that it was too much trouble than it was worth. And I think regardless of why people didn't vote, the fact that the voter ID law contributed to that, to me, is very concerning.
Jenny, thanks for the call. Ari, briefly, as we wrap up, it seems like voter ID laws have been spreading through the country pretty quickly. President convening a voter fraud commission now. What are you looking for in trends in the future?
Well, I think President Trump's commission is going to make recommendations for more things like voter ID laws. I think they're going to say that voter fraud is widespread, even though it's not. So I think it's very, very concerning. And I think we should be talking about the problems that people had casting a ballot. I think the kind of conversation that we had on your show is the kind of conversation we should be having in the future, as opposed to talking about voter fraud over and over and over like it's a major problem in American elections when it is not.
Ari, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Ari Berman, senior contributing writer for The Nation and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He joined us to talk about his most recent article looking at Wisconsin's voter photo ID law. A new study says it could have suppressed the ballots of as many as 200,000 voters in the state. Some people are skeptical about that number. You can share your thoughts, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page. What do you think of voter ID here in Wisconsin? Let us know online. Sometimes the high technology world gives us the thing we really wanted. Sometimes it gives us something we needed, but didn't know it until it existed. This weekend, a new app came out that you probably didn't know you needed. It's the Not Hot Dog app, now available on the Apple Store, not for my phone, though. What does it do? Just point it at something, anything, and it will tell you if it's a hot dog or not a hot dog. Now, this isn't a marketing failure, not a brilliant idea gone wrong. It's a play on the HBO show Silicon Valley. It's a comedy. The main characters try to create an app that can identify any type of food, but they only get as far, apparently, as hot dogs. There are some reviews of the app up there already. Here's one. Almost ate a slice of pizza thinking it was a hot dog. This app saved the day and probably my life. 5 stars. Another review says, amazing creation. It helped me identify hot dogs so I don't eat shoes or other non-hot dog things. 5 stars. I tried to pull a clip from that Silicon Valley show. I would have had to bleep most of it, I think. So it seemed pretty funny. Seemed like a pretty good thing. If you want to check out the Not Hot Dog app, please take it for a spin. Let us know if it is successful at telling hot dogs from non-hot dogs. Staying on the cutting edge of technology, this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.